I have no disclosures, no relationship disclosures, and the obligatory disclaimer, the presentations here are my own and not those of the Department of Defense, the Army, or the Army Medical Department. Why is this issue important? Why should, you know, some, you know, reserve captain who has never been to either Iraq or Afghanistan come before you and bring this issue to your attention? Well, I think for a number of reasons, especially for citizenship reasons. You know, I think public attention on some of the current conflicts has maybe diminished. I don't think it was even much of an issue with the recent elections. But Operation Enduring Freedom in Afghanistan is now our longest large-scale combat deployment in U.S. military history. And it's an unprecedented era of op tempo, which means unit deployments, and pers tempo, which means personnel deployments, individual people deploying. One of the interesting things that is important to understand is that our standard military enlistment lengths, the contract lengths, are unchanged from what they were prior to starting Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom, despite the significant burdens and repetitive combat deployments on our forces. And as you all know, repetitive deployments do have a significant impact on personnel and their families. Just going to go through some real quick basic terminology so you understand some of the acronyms and some slides. The military service obligation is the MSO. Basically, anyone who signs a contract generally for the military comes in on an 8-year contract, and that is served in some combination of their active duty obligation and then the remainder in the individual ready reserve. The ADSO is the active duty service obligation, and that's the portion of that 8-year contract that must be fulfilled through active duty service. Generally, with some exceptions, for enlisted personnel of all the branches, that's a 4-year obligation. It can be 2 to 3 years and as much as 5, depending on certain specialties and training. Generally, for an officer coming out of officer candidate school or a non-scholarship ROTC graduate like myself, it's a 3-year obligation, 4 years for an ROTC scholarship winner, and 5 years for a graduate of the service academies. Selected reserve. Those are what you traditionally would think of as a reserve or National Guard member. They belong to a unit. They participate in training, generally once a month, sometimes more frequently, and some type of annual training. Individual ready reserve, that's what I'm a member of. That is people who are still, you know, have to serve off the remainder of their 8 years in kind of an inactive status, or personnel like myself who have completed that but still want to maintain some military affiliation and go to APHA and do all kinds of neat things. 6x2, that's the general terminology shorthand for someone who's enlisting in the Guard or Reserve. That's 6 years in a selected reserve unit status followed by 2 years in the inactive reserve. That's how they do their 8 years. To understand where we are today, we have to go through some historical understanding of past practices. World War II, as you may or may not be aware, the ADSO standard was for the duration. However, as early as 1943, reams of research documented that prolonged tours had devastating effect on troop morale and the neuropsychiatric health of infantry. These are, you know, very, very well documented, and as early as 43, we were seeing this on ground forces as well with bomber crews. And post-war research done in 46 and 47 determined that based on ETO, European Theater of Operations casualty rates, 180 days of prolonged combat exposure represented the burnout point for frontline infantry, you know, artillery soldiers. And basically, soldiers with greater than 180 days of combat exposure had neuropsychiatric casualty rates higher than fresh replacements. World War II, there really is no comparison, I think, with you know, the percentage of casualties and certainly the raw numbers. So what I'm about to say, I'm not trying to, you know, say anything different than that, but we have to put what for the duration means in context. Preparing for this, I did some research, and the Army unit, the Army division, with the longest cumulative combat exposure in all of World War II was the 32nd Infantry Division, which was about 654 days. That equates to less than 2 current 1-year combat tours, which, you know, with our current operational tempo, units are being exposed to repeatedly. Is anyone here from the state of Wisconsin? Okay, well, that's the Wisconsin National Guard patch, so I was just going to point that out to somebody. Many story units that we all know and read about and revere served less than 1 year of cumulative combat time. The Band of Brothers, which has gotten many accolades deservedly for their service, was only 11 months. They jumped into D-Day and VE Day in May of 1945. The 10th Mountain Division, who I served with on active duty, less than 120 days of prolonged combat in World War II. And the lessons learned from World War II for the duration policy prompted, in our future conflicts, the use of an individual replacement policy in Korea and Vietnam. Korea, we had kind of two different policies for the first half of the war and the second half of the war. Up until September of 1951, personnel were required to serve a minimum of 6 months if they were in a combat unit, or 12 months in a support unit to be eligible for rotation back to CONUS, Continental United States. In August of 1951, they came up with a new point system, constructive months of service, and basically you were awarded a point system of 1 month in a combat unit, you got 4 points, and 1 month in a rear area, you got 2 points. Basically, enlisted soldiers, when they accumulated 43 points, they were sent home. Officers, 55 points, they were rotated home. Other than two Army divisions, our entire time in the Korean conflict, both for the Army and the Marines, it was an individual replacement personnel system. Again, that was driven because of some of the lessons we learned in World War II. Vietnam, most people here are probably more familiar with this. Again, another individual replacement personnel system. Tremendous debate within the military as we were ramping up to Vietnam, should we go to a unit-based system or an individual system? And based on the lessons of World War II, the individual system went out. Interesting note, in doing my research, I came across a 1987 article from a DOD publication that basically said that we would probably never go back to a unit-based rotation system for a prolonged conflict. That was how strongly influencing World War II and Korea were on those decisions. And this was heavily influenced by disease, non-battle injury, both in our tropical environment in Southeast Asia during World War II, and also the neuropsychiatric casualty rates. Interestingly, the tour length for combat soldiers in Vietnam was actually about, on average, 3 months more than it was in Korea. And we had a significant Army presence in Europe and the United States at that time. I mean, today we still have forces in Germany and Italy, but they are on the same deployment cycle to Iraq and Afghanistan as someone at Fort Hood, Texas is. But really, in Vietnam, we truly had a separate 200,000-person Army in Europe that those units were never pulled for rotation into Southeast Asia. And there were no extensions or multiple tours for first-time enlisted soldiers unless they affirmatively extended or re-enlisted. For the Army, if you made it to that 365th day, you were going home, and unless you re-upped, that was it. Transition to the all-volunteer force. A number of things came together that kind of got us to the point of where we are. If you go back and read the President's Commission on the All-Volunteer Force, the Gates Commission, which I have, the entire premise of the AVF was that the draft would be restored in the event of a prolonged conflict. That was the baseline that the AVF was built on. And because of recruiting challenges and some of the other things going on in the 1970s, basically cost and other problems necessitated to keep people longer. Before the AVF for the Army, the active duty service obligation was 2 years for a draftee and generally 3 years for a volunteer. And then post-AVF, we went to basically for the Army a four-year standard enlistment contract and certain 2-, 3-, 5-year contracts, but those were really minorities. And then in 1984, a decision was made with DOD that the military service obligation was extended from 6 to 8 years. Prior to 84, the contract you came in was for a total of 6, and then it went to 8. So where are we today? As I explained before, the enlistment terms and lanes virtually unchanged from 2001. Many first-term Army soldiers are serving 2 1-year tours on their initial enlistment, and some first-term soldiers, because of stop loss, actually serve 3 tours between 2005 and 2009. Thankfully, stop loss is being scaled back, and that is an issue of the past. The Marines normally serve 7-month tours, and multiple tours, again, for the first-termers are routine. And OEF, OIF, and OND, Operation New Dawn, are the first prolonged conflicts in U.S. history with the unit-based rotation system. The unit-based
rotation... Do you want to define those for people who might not be...
Operation Enduring Freedom, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and now it's Operation New Dawn in Iraq. Interesting thing about the unit-based rotation policy is that it places a premium on conserving the fighting strength and a unit's deployable combat strength. So really, it's gone from a soldier-focused system to a unit-focused system. And I personally have friends who did not even get a year between tours. They came back, they were reassigned to a new unit, and 6 months later, they were going back for another year. So the unit's deployability, it takes primacy. And we also have gone to the inactive reserve recalls. And despite what some people will say, it's really an unprecedented use of the inactive reserve. IRR personnel have been used since the summer of 2004 to fill very junior-level, entry-level functions in deploying units as individual replacements. Many of these soldiers, and I saw them on my last muster with the IRR, have already deployed some 2, some 3 times, and yet they still are facing these repetitive call-ups from the IRR. And unlike previous IRR call-ups, this one is different. Korea, largely officers used as cadre and trainers to build new units of draftees. Berlin, used as more of a strategic reserve show of force. Desert Storm, we called up the IRR to provide replacements in the event of massive casualties which were not expected. But now we are calling them up individually and immediately putting them into deployable units for a year. This is a glimpse of the current personnel tempo. This came from the Army's 2010 suicide report, which is an excellent document. A lot of the information I have came from that. And this just kind of shows where we are. You know, soldier enlists, he gets assigned to the 101st Airborne at Fort Campbell, deploys, comes back, gets reassigned to the 25th Infantry Division in Hawaii, deploys, comes back, gets reassigned to Fort Bragg, North Carolina with the 82nd Airborne, deploys again. This is a very optimistic career path. What we're seeing is right out of basic training and AIT, 14 weeks of infantry training, right out of the gate, people are going to that first unit and they're going overseas for a year, coming back for a year, and then going back again. That's how you get the two deployments in the first enlistment. And they do take a toll. In 2008, 13% of the active Army met the screening requirements for PTSD. And as you can see, the number of new PTSD cases increased from 2,900 to over 10,000 in 08. And interestingly, in this report, I couldn't believe this, so it's actually here if anyone wants to see it. In March 2010, 14% of active Army personnel were on prescription opiate medications for a variety of issues. And in 08, approximately 5% of our soldiers were prescribed antidepressants, SSRIs generally, within 90 days of deployment or during their combat deployment. Again, that is aggregated over the total force. I have friends of mine who are medical logisticians who have, you know, deployed with brigade combat teams, and in some of the combat units that actually as high as 20% on SSRIs and Ambien. And this is just an example of how the op tempo can have an impact on mental health. Again, this is an official Army chart that came from the 2010 suicide report showing that the length of time at home diminishes the possible adverse behavioral health outcomes in future deployments. Thank you. So right now, currently, for most units, in combat units, it's a 12-month dwell time between the deployments. So that can fluctuate, you know, this is very low, but with 95th confidence interval, possibly as high as 30% of people coming forward with behavioral health issues. But if that unit can get extended out to just even 3 years at home, that gets cut in half. Decrease in separations. We've kept a lot of people in who in previously conflicts we would have chaptered out, separated, but because of the exigencies of deployable personnel, that hasn't happened. The Army estimated that it had about 25,000 folks who probably in 2010 that would have been chaptered out under previous standards, but who were kept in. In July, we had over 1,000 soldiers with two or more founded felony offenses who remained in active duty. And the entry-level separations for, you know, new soldiers failing to adjust to the Army decreased dramatically from almost 5,000 in 02 to a little over 2,000 in 09. And there's nowhere to take a knee. The active duty generating force, our institutional Army positions, have been slashed during the war and freed up through outsourcing, military to civilian conversions, and the mobilization of reservists to fill them. Since 2001, the Army has grown almost 65,000 soldiers, but the non-deployable, you know, positions where you can, you know, take a breather for your family have been decreased almost 30,000. And the bottom acronym there is the individual augmentee system. Even the people who were in those positions are getting called up individually to deploy out of them. We all know about the suicide issue. This is a real issue for public health alarm. This is the age and gender-adjusted civilian rate, and here's the Marines, and here's the Army projected over the past years. This likely, I don't say this definitively, but this likely understates the problem for two reasons. It's only adjusted for age and gender. It's not adjusted for other factors. Entering cohort into the military, the bottom quintile of family income is very underrepresented in the incoming cohort. Secondly, the Armed Forces qualification test to come into the service. For the Air Force, I mean, you really can't even come in as an enlisted airman unless you score in the top half, the 50th percentile above in that test. In the Army, it's about 31 and above. Also, we have virtually no high school dropouts, so we, you know, should be seeing, you know, an even more robust group, and yet this is still happening. Suicides by select demographic. The green is the percentage of their percentage in the Army population. Tan is the percentage of the suicides. Infantry is higher represented. Males, Caucasians, which are overrepresented in the combat units, and junior enlisted. suicide rate and behavioral health diagnosis. There is, you know, an issue there. There is something to be concerned about. The flat line at the bottom is the, you know, people with non-behavioral health problems for Army soldiers, no history of diagnosis, kind of the suicide rate per 100,000. But yet with anxiety disorder, substance abuse, major depression, it multiple times higher. Army misdemeanor offenses, this kind of speaks for itself between 04 and 09. Sexual offenses, and those including alcohol. DUIs, interestingly, at any given time because of the op tempo, 30% of the Army isn't driving a civilian car and they can't drink, but yet we're having this. Implications for medical personnel. I couldn't not come to APHA without bringing that. Medical personnel have some of the longest active duty service obligation requirements in the military. For someone who goes to the military medical school USUS and who was an ROTC scholarship winner, it's an 11-year payback post-residency, 12 years post-residency for an academy grad who does that. Graduate school, at least for the Army, has very extensive payback, frequently 4 years for a master's and 5 to 6 years for a PhD. And these long ADSOs mean repetitive deployments for personnel in shortage specialties. We've been using U.S. Public Health Service and civilian people to backfill some of these stateside positions, but there's still tremendous strain on the force. I'm going to go through two examples here real quick. Social workers. Fiscal year 11, we had 173 active duty Army social workers, but our objective force strength was 237. And we have a significant shortage of mid-career personnel. And although we're leveraging civilians in the public health service to provide the stateside, services, that's still not giving much relief to the deployable force. This is the social work, as you can see here, in the mid-career, some pretty gaping vacancies. Army clinical psychology. They cut what the objective was, so that's why we have a little bit of a change of numbers here between 11 and 10, but again, significant shortages. And as you can see here, especially for more of the senior psychologists, you know, just some big gaps. It's even worse before they cut the objective force. We had some big shortages in FY10. Closing thoughts. As the adverse effects of repetitive deployments become more evident, a reevaluation of the current ADSO requirement is overdue. A first-term soldier or Marine can potentially serve over 720 days in combat on their first enlistment and still be subject to future inactive reserve recall deployment. While more costly and outreach-intensive, shorter enlistments can better distribute the rewards and burdens of service among a U.S. population and also provide a deeper bench of trained manpower in a crisis. And there's been myriad studies. Charles Moskos, the esteemed military sociologist out of Northwestern, showed that the willingness of people, especially from higher SES incomes, to join the military correlates with a shorter service obligation. If you make the obligation longer, and I saw this as a recruiter, it was a much shorter, much less likelihood that they would be interested in joining. So we have some, I don't know if we're going to do questions, and I dedicate the talk. This was the unit I served with on active duty, and I welcome some of these guys out of basic training, and that's just wanted to remember them with Veterans Day coming up.